From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Kim Lewis, your guest host for this discussion. We are going to focus on a worldwide issue that has shown to have increased in some areas of the world, and that is child marriage. The child advocacy organization, UNICEF, says while the prevalence of child marriage has decreased worldwide from 1 in 4 girls married a decade ago to approximately 1 in 5 today, the practice remains widespread. The organization also found that before the COVID-19 pandemic, more than 100 million girls were expected to marry before their 18th birthday in the next decade. Now, up to 10 million girls will be at risk of becoming child brides because of the pandemic. In a recent release, UNICEF warns that girls as young as 12 are being forced into child marriage and are undergoing female genital mutilation, FGM, at alarming rates in the Horn of Africa. Their assessment points out that in Kenya, girls are also facing greater risk of child marriage and FGM. 14 of the 23 counties affected by drought are already FGM hotspots, with prevalence rates up to 98%. Girls in these areas are now in danger of being cut at younger ages as families prepare them for marriage. There are also reports of girls living in border regions being taken to neighboring countries to undergo FGM or being married to older men in neighboring countries where rates of FGM may be higher. UNICEF says their data on child marriage and FGM is limited due to a lack of reporting services in the region. However, available data found that the present crisis is forcing increasing numbers of girls to leave school, putting them at a higher risk for child marriage and FGM. The region is experiencing some of the worst droughts it has seen in 40 years, causing families to take extreme measures to survive. For example, UNICEF's analysis shows in parts of Ethiopia worst affected by the drought, child marriage has on average more than doubled in a span of 1 year. In Somaliland in January, almost a quarter of people interviewed reported a rise in gender-based violence, including child marriage, domestic violence, and sexual violence, with increases of more than 50% in some locations. Humanitarian Needs in Puntland in February found that child marriage accounted for 59% of cases reported to service providers, many of which also involved FGM. UNICEF found the number of children at risk of dropping out of school in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia due to the impact of the drought has tripled in the space of 3 months, from 1.1 million to an estimated 3.3 million children. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has caused food and fuel prices to soar, and the drought has dried up water sources and killed off livestock. The combination of all these factors has caused growing numbers of parents or caregivers to marry off girls to secure dowries to help support the rest of the family. It can also be seen as having one less mouth to feed or an attempt to help the bride enter a more secure household. The child marriages can involve men up to 5 times the age of the girl. To discuss these recent assessments and alarming statistics is Andy Brooks, UNICEF's Regional Child Protection Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa. Thank you, Mr. Brooks, for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Also joining us is my colleague, Rick Pantaleo, host of the Science Edition of PCUSA and Science in a Minute. Thank you, Rick, for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Kim.
Rick, let's start off with you. I know this is an issue of great concern to you, and you have some questions you would like to pose to Mr. Brooks, so we can start off. I'll turn it over to you.
Well, my question that I've been curious about is a very fundamental one. What is child marriage? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is almost universally ratified by all countries in the world, defines a child as somebody under the age of 18. So when we talk about child marriage, we're referring to any formal marriage or informal union. People get together in different ways between a child and the under the age of 18 and an adult, or indeed another child. Two children marrying each other is also child marriage.
And how common is child marriage around the world? both in developing and developed nations?
It's very common. We recently produced a statistical overview of trends and actual situation in terms of child marriage. And we estimated 650 million people currently have experienced child marriage. Let me just precise that. That means both children now who are under the age of 18 and who are actually married from the age of 15 upwards, or those that are over 18 but were married as children. Those between the ages of 18 and 24 were also asked that question, were you married as a child? And when you compile all those household survey data together, it comes to 650 million, 130 million in Africa. It's an incredibly big problem and issue.
Mr. Brooks, while UNICEF says overall child marriage has decreased over the past decade, it is still widespread, and now the Horn of Africa is experiencing an increase. To understand the mindset of families in the Horn of Africa, we have to understand really the desperate situation that they are presently experiencing. What has been the root cause of this huge increase in child marriages there?
I like the way you formulated the question. It's important before we get to that crux to recognize that over the years, this is an issue that's gained significant global development political attention. And if, for example, we look at 1990, where are we now? That's 30, 32 years ago. In Ethiopia, one of the countries we're talking about, 7 in 10 girls were getting married. And as of 2015, it's 4 in 10. So that's a significant reduction. And we do have to acknowledge that progress. But indeed, as we zone into the Horn of Africa, and just to make clear, when we talk about the Horn of Africa, we're talking about Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia, and particularly the areas most affected by this devastating drought that's going on at the moment, the southeast corner of Ethiopia, the northern part of Kenya, and the belt that comes across them in Somalia. These are the areas anyway where girls were disproportionately affected by the practice of female genital mutilation and child marriage. And now imagine a situation in which there's been such a significant level of displacement. We have over 10 million children affected by this crisis. They've had to move, devastating, limited access to food and water, nearly 2 million children severely and acutely malnourished in those three countries, between 1 and 3 million children dropping out of school. This is the kind of canvas on which families are resorting to very difficult coping strategies, including marrying their girls younger, marrying more of their girls, having their girls' genitalia cut, sometimes in order as a preparation for their girls to get married. So it's a series of very stressful situations in which families are having to make very difficult choices in the immediate term that are going to have very long-term consequences throughout their childhoods and indeed their adult lives as well.
Mr. Brooks, reading about child marriages, we often see a pretty much nightmare scenario where there's a massive age difference between the child bride, for example, and the groom. How common is this, and what's the usual age difference between a child bride and her husband?
That's a great question. It brings to mind the story I heard in northern Kenya of a 10-year-old girl who was betrothed to a 70-year-old man. That was a situation drawn to our attention by the social workers working up there. It was in this case, it was a very fortunate escape. The girl found herself on a bus up to a situation that she didn't know was going to happen, where she was due to get married. And an uncle intervened to protect her and brought in the social services. And in that particular case, the child didn't get married. But just imagine a 10-year-old with a 70-year-old. And very often, these marriages are disproportionate ages. And with age comes already, we're dealing with contexts in which there is a high degree of gender inequality. And then throw into that the age difference from the man to the girl, and you get issues of domestic violence coming in, control of finances, power coming into play. I can't tell you the mean age difference between. There's been situations like the 10 to the 70-year-old, just as you could have a 15 to a 25, 26-year-old. But these engagements and unions are often characterized by power inequalities, by poverty, particularly for the girl, limited or no control of her own future in terms of finances or resources, often leading to very young childcare responsibilities, children as young as 12, 13, having their first child, having six or seven by the time they're 30, and often trapped in these situations. You can imagine that's the kind of dynamic facing many of them. And the worst of it is, if we look at the profile of most of the girls that are getting married, they're from the poorest households. They're from the most rural areas. They're the girls that dropped out of school quickest. And therefore, these kinds of marriages into which they go are leading to intergenerational cycles of poverty and, in some cases, violence and oppression for the girls concerned.
And also, in looking at just the social and community workers who are there to provide assistance, well, how is this impacting them and their jobs? Because they're trying to educate as well, and they also have to deal with the culture in that community.
Absolutely. And I mean, that question could be asked when things are going reasonably okay. But add on to that the extreme circumstances I mentioned earlier, and you find out that a lot of those child and community workers, social workers themselves have been displaced. They've left. Many of the schools in that region and the teachers in them are paid by the community, actually. They're not on the state payroll. And they've left too because there's no more money to pay them. And kids are not going to school because the teachers are not there or they've been displaced. And so the adult sphere of protection, which protects the kid within it, is also being decimated by this drought through displacement, through poverty. And so, I mean, I was not long ago in Somali region, which is actually in Ethiopia. It's borders with Somalia. And we had arranged to meet some girls we've been working with for a long time on child marriage. Adolescent group of girls, life skills coming together, trying to empower them, supporting access to reproductive health services and so on. And actually, very few of these girls showed up. They're not able to come to those groups anymore. They're facing long walks to go and get firewood, to go and get water. They're increasingly put upon for childcare responsibilities. So their lives and the solidarity they had between them has also kind of fragmented significantly. And there's a massive need to scale up the support to those structures. Yes, the girls, but what you rightly said, the frontline workers, the supporters, the social workers, the community workers, they're being fragmented. And we, as much as possible, we need to get to these girls and get to these communities and not see this crisis as one which somehow facilitates mass displacement and then kind of reach them in a camp situation, which takes time to establish in the first place. And then it already takes them away from most of the resources and assets for which they would feel most, you know, which would be their main form of support.
Mr. Brooks, I'm curious. I realize that most of these child marriages are precipitated by economic means, and especially with the dire situation in the Horn of Africa, with the long drought happening there and the economic pressure on these families. How does a child marriage happen then based on these terms? Is it strictly economic?
It's not strictly economic, but let's look at the economic side first. So very often in those situations, there's a dowry offered, some financial, some cattle often, some assets are exchanged for the girl to be betrothed to another family and to marry, often, as we've discussed, an older man. These dowries in the current situation are decreasing in value. People have less money to offer dowries, but the people with the girls in their household have less money to survive and look after the girls, which are their children. And so oftentimes what we've seen, and we've seen that in Somalia particularly, a family might be getting more than one of their girls wed, if you like, in exchange for the kind of level of the dowry that they would have had previously. So it's leading to an escalation in the number of girls families are marrying off with less in return, if you like. And I say that carefully, you know, and not in any pejorative sort of way. These are survival tactics in desperate situations that families are resorting to very, very difficult decisions that they have to make. There are also in these situations, and not only the Horn of Africa, but many humanitarian situations, there's a situation where there's an increase of sexual violence and girls are much more at risk. And sometimes this can lead families to get their girls wed. Instead of the girl experiencing sexual violence, maybe getting pregnant, and this sometimes bringing shame on the family and putting the family in a difficult situation where they would not be able to get that girl married, as a preventive or preemptive strategy, the girl would be married before this could happen to her. For her own protection in some sense, but nevertheless, we're talking about a very vulnerable child and all the dynamics around the power and the violence that we discussed earlier. These are the kinds of dilemmas and difficult situations that many of these families are living with right now.
Time now for a short break, and when we return, we'll continue our discussion. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is UNICEF's Regional Child Protection Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa, Andy Brooks. I'm Kim Lewis, along with my colleague Rick Pantaleo, host of the Science Edition of PCUSA and Science in a Minute. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voaafrica.com. Now back to our discussion on the alarming increase of child marriage in the Horn of Africa. Our guest is UNICEF's Regional Child Protection Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa, Andy Brooks. And I wanted to bring in another aspect of this. Across the Horn of Africa, four rainy seasons have failed in the space of 2 years, with forecasts suggesting a fifth rainy season from October to December is also likely to fail. So on top of this forecast, and in looking at the war in Ukraine, which is worsening the crisis, what is the cause and effect, I guess, of Russia's invasion of Ukraine on families in the Horn of Africa?
I think you've described almost the kind of perfect storm, a cocktail of ingredients that have come together at one time to really make life so difficult. And the magnitude of the response that's required versus the incredible vulnerability of the population, that's a gap that, you know, I'm appealing to anybody listening, needs to be closed. The funding to support this, the kind of scale up of the services that we talked about earlier on to support this population. And maybe that's part of it, you know, that the crisis in Ukraine has attracted so much donor attention that it's distracted attention from places like the Horn of Africa, where in fact the severity and the vulnerability of the population is extremely high. The lives that will be lost, have been lost, are extremely high. And we can look at health, we can look at nutrition, we can look at protection across the board, basic livelihoods. These are often pastoral people whose livelihoods are defined by their cattle. Their cattle are largely dead. You see the carcasses everywhere you want to go in that region. You see spread carcasses across the landscape. So the means and the assets by which these people proudly survive have been taken away from them. And that's going to take a lot to recover. So if we look more specifically at Ukraine, beyond the neglect it can cause or has caused for this particular crisis, there are direct effects as well. I mean, I have some figures for the level of imported grain that comes from either the Russian Federation or Ukraine to these three countries. It's very high, 67% in Ethiopia, in Kenya, 87%, and in Somalia, 92%. So these are incredibly high levels of dependency. In Somalia alone, the price of staple cereals and cooking oil has gone up by 160%. And as we know, as we've discussed in this globally, this is not only affecting the Horn of Africa, the issue of fuel and food spikes, but the global trade of sunflower oil and seeds and the price of food, cooking oil, wheat flour, is extremely dependent. I believe that 53% of the global trade in sunflower oil and seed is coming from Ukraine and the Russian Federation. So it has a massive effect, as you can see. You can see indirectly in terms of turning tension away from what in most times, for all of what you said, the failed rains and so on, the severity of the drought, the amount of displacement, the level of severe and acute malnutrition, tension has been turned away to Ukraine, indirect effect of the crisis, and then direct effect through the dependency on food products, cooking oil, wheat, etc. So there's a very real and direct connection between the two.
Mr. Brooks, I'm curious about the legal aspect of child marriages. Do these children have any legal recourse at all anywhere? Is there someone that can, you know, from a legal standpoint, help them in their situation?
Well, let's start with the laws themselves, which are not all perfect across the world, by the way. Let's not just focus that observation on the Horn of Africa or even Africa. But what I can say is there's been a massive improvement in terms of legal standards of protection for girls and boys not to get married before the age of 18. There are still some countries where there's a discriminatory clause in the law allowing girls to get married younger than boys. But then I think across the board, the enforcement of these laws is something that's really an area that UNICEF, for example, particularly is paying a lot more attention to. We have been working in several countries. We have support of a global program to end child marriage, supported by a number of important donors to address this issue. And this has led to a much increased, if I just take Ethiopia, for example, last year we had 16,000 cases of girls about to be married, incidents of child marriage reported, compared to a previous year of 3,700. So in a way, you could say that makes it look as if things are getting worse, but it's not. It's actually a testament to an increased surveillance and reporting system that is pointing out 16,000 girls as opposed to 3,700. And within that, 3,000 of them could be nullified and could be addressed. So 3,000 out of 16,000 is not enough, but there is a growing capacity and recourse for these girls to be able to use the legal framework to protect themselves. But there's still so much more to do. Like I said, many of the girls are getting married out of sight, in rural areas, out of the way of protective services, all the more reason to scale up and improve the presence of these kind of frontline workers we were talking about earlier, the facilities to be able to detect and support and report what's happening to those girls.
Now, the international community, what do they need to do at this point, considering all the major distractions going on in the world right now?
Well, for a start, I think this kind of an interview, and I thank you for it, is a good opportunity to draw attention to the severity and scale of what's happening in the Horn of Africa and the kinds of numbers. One of the things we need to do much better is avoid these kinds of conversations and anticipate ahead of time what's going to happen. There was a recent report by a START network which spoke about the number of crises around the world in which some level of anticipation of just how severe they are could be, and then looked at the level of funding. I think it was 1% of funding that goes into anticipatory preparedness actions versus response. And of course, you know, the key message there is that anticipatory preparedness funding saves a lot of money down the line. So I think that's important. And we're talking often in the Horn of Africa of cyclical droughts. This one, admittedly, is much worse than we could have anticipated. But we're in the context now, and we're talking all the time about it, around climate change, increasingly unpredictable trends of weather, but a certain predictability that things will be unpredictable. And there's a real need to get hold of that. The other thing is that a lot of the vulnerability is characterized by remoteness and people who are far away from any kind of support, either the kind of community and human resources support we were talking about or services. So there's a much greater need to either target, based on assessments, where the most vulnerable people are and put assets and resources in there, or step up the mobile services. One of the things UNICEF is doing a lot of is mobile health clinics, for example, that also look at nutrition, that also look at protection, and can look at also issues around violence and child marriage and bring these into a more integrated response around health and nutrition, for example. But education is really the key. If we keep girls in school, whether that's in the Horn of Africa, whether that's in humanitarian contexts or other contexts where child marriage is prevalent, keeping girls in school and providing alongside that cash assistance, financial support for families and livelihoods, these are really the game changers. So it's a macroeconomic reform. And if we look at South Asia, I had given a figure to your colleague of a 650 million. The weight the burden of girls who are getting married is still in South Asia, but it's changing dramatically because of the increased opportunities for women and the efforts on gender equality that are now providing girls with more choices, families with more choices than marrying their girls as children. That's an area where in Africa, we still have a lot to do and a lot to do to build on these policy commitments, legal commitments that have been put in place in many places, but need to be followed through much more closely with budget investment from governments and the international community to really make sense and translate the kind of paper commitments into action and support for girls on the ground.
Mr. Brooks, I understand that there are a number of factors behind child marriage, much of which you have already discussed. But from what I understand and have read is that there are cultural customs and religious beliefs that are also behind the practice of child marriage. For people trying to stem child marriages, try to get them banned and so forth, has there been any concerns regarding insensitivity to these local cultural customs and religious beliefs?
Yes, I think within any strategy or efforts to engage and understand better and support girls in these situations, an understanding of the local social norms, the way people have done things over the years, the way decisions are made in communities, is critical, and an engagement with the faith leaders and traditional leaders has been very much part of the efforts that UNICEF and associated partners have been doing. And that means it's a real dialogue. That doesn't mean don't do this or this will happen, a kind of punitive approach. There's real limitations to that kind of approach. It has to be based much more on an understanding of the culture, but also an understanding beyond the way norms were set of the very real consequences this has for girls. You know, girls dropping out of school leads to a devastating lifelong poverty for many of them. The violence that I mentioned earlier, the health consequences for teenage girls having children, for their children and for themselves. The practice of female genital mutilation can be catastrophic for girls and young women throughout their lives. It can be fatal, unfortunately, in childbirth for some girls. So there are a number of norms and traditions. Yes, there are often religious beliefs that go with some of these practices. They have to be understood. They have to be discussed and they have to be talked through. But alongside that, there needs to be an effort also to engage and help folks understand the real consequences for the girls themselves of these practices and to influence the people that are most decisive in these practices. I remember when I was working in Guinea many years ago, which is, I think, second or third highest prevalence of female genital mutilation in the world, what they call the exiseurs, the women, often women of a certain age, who carried out the practice. It was a livelihood for them. So if you take it away from them, you need to understand that that will have consequences and that's going to be something that's going to be difficult for them. So how do you work with those people to offer alternatives as well, rather than just deny their source of income? Things have to be looked at very holistically.
Well, Mr. Brooks, we'll have to end the show on that note as we are out of time. I want to thank you first for all of your dedication and compassion to this work. And we thank you for taking the time to talk with us about why child marriage is increasing in the Horn of Africa and what it will take to reduce and ultimately stop this abuse of girls.
I was happy to stay with you and I really appreciate the opportunity that you give us to talk about these things. They're very important. So many thanks, and wishing you both a good day.
Okay, thank you.
The best.
Thanks again.
Our guest, UNICEF's Regional Child Protection Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa, Andy Brooks. I also want to thank my colleague, host of VOA's Science Edition of PCUSA and Science in a Minute, Rick Pantaleo. Before we close, a reminder to tune in to our sister show, Encounter. Host Carol Castiel returns to her hometown of Newcastle, Pennsylvania, to discuss the state of play in that battleground state in the run-up to the midterm elections. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join Carol Castiel next weekend for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.